My name's Chuck Huff. A lot of people call me Chucky Huff. It's all one word.
Chuckyhuff.com.
Well, you are taping. Thank you.
Chuckyhuff.com.
Chuckyhuff.com. And the name of this session is Why the Internet Will Not Change Your Life. I'm a psychologist. I teach at St. Olaf College, and I've been studying electronic communication for about 15 years. I started when I was a graduate student at Princeton, and in the summers I didn't have any support, but Bell Labs was hiring people, and they wanted some psychologists to come up and study electronic communication. And so since I didn't have a way to eat, that was a nice way to eat. I was really very interested in it, and I started there. And then I went to Carnegie Mellon University for a couple of years, and did research while I was there. And then I went to St. Olaf College, where I've kept on this this research. There's a fair number of social scientists, psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists, etc., who have been studying the internet. It's now beginning to be a hot thing. A colleague of mine, who was just on a panel with him a couple of months ago, said he finally started calling himself a cyber anthropologist. He gets weird looks from people when he does that, but he said he's figured somebody had to start. So that's what he says he does. Most of the research I have done has been on how people communicate over electronic media, how that changes their organizations, how they feel about each other. And that's been one line of research. Another line of work has been on gender issues having to do with computing and the internet. And I've also done some work on ethical issues associated with the design of software and that sort of stuff. So I've been playing in this for a little while. It's a great deal of fun. And well, let me give you some feeling for what I want to do. In a couple of weeks, I'm giving a talk at St. Olaf at the Summer Theology Conference that's titled, somewhat arrogantly, God, the Self, and Cyberspace. I couldn't think of anything else in January when they asked me for a title, and now I'm stuck with it. They've printed it and all the brochures and everything. And so I've been thinking about this for 6 months. And I thought what I would do is to share with you some of the ideas that I have been coming up with regard to religion and religious practice on the internet. I thought this would be a great place to sort of trot these ideas out and get your feedback. And so you're seeing the maiden voyage of these ideas, and I'm sorry for that burden on you, but what I have seen from Holden folks, it's usually a creative bunch of people who can do pretty well even if the speaker screws up. So what I want to do then is first to do some background stuff about some of the social, some of the sociological work that's already been done on the internet, so you have some feel of where this is coming from. And that's on this side of the board. And then I want to move to talking specifically about religion and how the things we know then about electronic interaction might have something to say about how religion might be changed or might not pick up the internet as a useful tool. And I really hope to get you all's feedback on this. The first title up there is Stuff to Avoid When You're Thinking About the Internet. I'm a social scientist, and so I do my very best before talking about things to spend a great deal of time collecting data. For instance, I'd like to talk to you about gender bias in web advertisements, you know, the banners that occur across web pages. But I don't have that data yet. My students are collecting it this summer. We are pretty sure that the same kind of biases occur in advertisements on the internet as occur in regular print magazines, but we want to go out and collect the data first before we make any pronouncements. On the other hand, the kind of stuff that you see in Time magazine often, or in other popular magazines, often falls prey to some of these three different kinds of sloppy ways of thinking. One of them I've called nearsighted determinism. A lot of people think that if you build a technology, people will use it for the thing you planned it for, and it will work the way you intended. Hooey. all you have to do is take a look at the history of the internet. The history of the internet was not about communication among people when it was first designed. The whole point of the internet when it first designed was about communication among machines to share computer resources for doing these fancy weather models and other sorts of things. But it turned out that the scientists who were using it could do electronic mail. Boy, was that cool. And electronic mail and the web are now sort of the mainstay of the traffic on the internet, rather than the early vision. People keep telling me that real soon we're going to be doing video conferencing a lot, forgetting that the first video telephone was introduced in the 1950s, and it still hasn't caught on. If I have a video telephone and you don't, it doesn't do me any good. So there's the issue of getting enough of them up. And people simply didn't want to be seen in their pajamas when they answered the telephone. That's part of it, I think. And there have been sociologists who've looked at the issue of why people adopted particular technologies and that sort of thing. And so a nearsighted determinism suggests that the technology will do this to you, and it will change the world this way. But in fact, what it is the choices that we make in response to the technology shapes how it's used. And I want to talk some more about that when I talk about the choices that churches might make when they use technology. Another one is innovation fetishes. I use that as a key word for the folks who say this particular technology is so new that any of the studies that you social science geeks have done on old technology don't have any application to it at all, because it's so hot and cool that it will just take off. It's sort of a subversion of this nearsighted determinism, but the idea is that it didn't work before, but now we've got the answer, and it really will take off. People, before the web happened, what people were predicting would take off was something called WASE, Wide Area Integrated System. I can't remember what it was an acronym for, but it was a database sort of thing. But it didn't do pictures very well. And so the idea that the thing that you've invented is going to be what takes off ends up, by and large, being wrong. Most innovations, there's a whole bunch of people who study innovation. Most innovations fail. Those of you who have done startup businesses, most startup businesses fail. Most restaurants fail. We remember the ones that have succeeded. But by and large, most innovations don't turn out as promised. And even if they do turn out as promised, they often are used for something different. Another fallacy of thinking is anecdotal hang gliding. That is, you take one anecdote and you hang an explanation from it, and then you glide it all over the phenomenon. So, for instance, we find out that there are a few people who use the internet a great deal, and they neglect their personal hygiene, and they neglect their families and their studies, and they drop out of school, and they're connected to the internet as long as they can stay awake. And this has been parlayed into talk about internet addiction. And so what we do is we take a few very rich anecdotes, and these are people who really do have trouble, and create a phenomenon out of it called internet addiction. And then we blame it on the internet. Instead of looking at the kinds of people this is, who are doing it, and asking, well, if they didn't have the internet, what else would they be doing? And most of the social scientists who've looked at that have decided, well, these are the kinds of people who are likely to get wrapped up in something because they're not good at social interaction, they don't enjoy being around other people, and they're using it to get away. They might as well use television or some other thing. So, we get anecdotes about how in one company the use of technology has helped people on the line talk to line managers, and people on the line even talk to the vice president or the president. And then we say, well, technology, electronic communication is leveling. But in fact, if you look at the ways that technology is being used systematically, and that's this thing I try to do, and my colleagues try to do, is to go out and collect careful data on it. If you look at it across a bunch of organizations, you end up finding that by and large, it's the organizational culture that determines how electronic communication is used inside the organization. So the electronic communication doesn't flatten out the organization. An organization that wants to encourage communication across the levels of a hierarchy uses electronic mail to do that. And an organization that wants to discourage it uses electronic mail to do that. I don't know, does anybody here know of someone who has their secretary print out their electronic mail?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a way of distancing yourself from this supposed effect of electronic mail. And so the way we use the technology is the thing that determines its effect rather than the technology itself. Let me just real quickly scream over some research on the internet now. There are, the latest data that I was looking at is, I think, between 15 and 25% of the population of the U.S. now has access to the internet, and it depends upon how you count it and what you count, etc. Whether you're talking about access at work or access from home. It used to be that only about 10 to 15% of those folks were women. That's now up to about 40%. However, that data unfortunately doesn't tease out what those folks are doing. That is, 40% of the folks on the internet or who have internet access are women, but maybe what they are is the boss's secretary printing out his email, which doesn't suggest the kind of equality that 40% would suggest. We're getting a much larger age range now on the internet. A lot more people in 55 and up are on the internet, and among those people, you're seeing a broader range in income now. It used to be just the people that had a lot of money who were over 55 who had access to the internet. Now, you're seeing a much broader range of older people with access to the internet. There are sites on the internet now that are dedicated specifically to seniors. And I think the American Association of Retired Persons is now doing training for folks about how to get onto the internet and that sort of thing. By and large, more people are getting on the internet across the board, even those who are poor. But what you get is if this is time and this is the number of people, folks who have money are getting on the internet at a curve like that, and folks who don't have much money are getting on the internet at a curve like that. So the gap is growing. By the way, one thing you want to think about when you think about a curve like this is, when does that curve level out? If you hear some of the hype about the internet, there were some predictions, I think, that every person on the planet would have an internet connection by the year 2002 or something. Well, you know, that's just, again, to be polite, hooey. The kind of curves that you see for the diffusion of an innovation like this into a group of people looks more, you have a few people who are starting. This is the early years of the internet when just scientists were on. And then you get rapid diffusion and then it levels off. Now some things like telephones have leveled off at a very high rate. Some things like cell phones have leveled off down here. So one thing you want to ask yourself is, where is it going to level off in terms of the percentage of the U.S. population that has access? This is really a very serious issue, and those of us who are concerned about access to the net are unfortunately voices crying in the wilderness usually. We had the Rural Electrification Program, and we had subsidies to get stuff out to rural and to poor neighborhoods in terms of telephone access. We're not talking about that very much now at a national level for the internet. And if we think that's an important resource for folks, then we should talk more about it. Zooming right along. In experiments where they've taken folks, and some of my colleagues at Carnegie Mellon have done these studies, they've taken folks sort of in a vacuum and had them discuss either face-to-face a controversial issue or discuss over electronic mail a controversial issue, you see some clear differences in the way that communication works. People who discuss a controversial issue over electronic mail tend to be more excited about it. That's a nice way to say it. Another way to talk about it is flaming. They also tend to insult each other in grandstand and those sorts of things. Now, that's not all of the folks, but there's a significant percentage of people who will do it, and that percentage increases when you do it over electronic mail. It takes longer for groups in electronic interaction to come to some conclusion than it does if they're face-to-face. And I suppose part of that is because I can't, if I'm sharing electronic mail with you, lean across the table and look at you like you're just really stupid. Which has some effect that you don't get in electronic mail. And it's hard to do that in electronic mail because you have to do something that is like flaming and say, gosh, you must be really stupid to think that. Whereas in a face-to-face conversation, I can look at you like you're really stupid, and you can say, what are you doing? I say, oh, just something in my eye. and so I get some deniability of that kind of social pressure in face-to-face. So it's easier to do that social pressure. So we get some clear differences between the way people interact electronically and the way people interact face-to-face in these experimental settings. Now, those differences get a lot muddier when we embed them in organizations where people are actually know each other. Because I'm much less likely to send nasty, flaming electronic mail to somebody who is my supervisor. Or at least if I am likely to do that, I am not likely to remain employed at that place very long. So these sort of clean effects that you get in experimental studies get a little bit muddier when you put people into real organizations and have them and look at the effect of using electronic mail in real organizations. There are, however, some pretty interesting things that happen. One of them is that in an organization that is interested in broadening communication, electronic mail allows people who are isolated either in space or in time to feel more connected to the organization. This is some studies we've done actually in Fort Collins, Colorado that suggested this. When you look at firefighters who are on their shifts at weird times, and so they're not able to talk to the people who have the 9-to-5 jobs, if they have access to electronic mail, they feel a lot more like they're a part of what's going on in the organization. People who are at remote sites. One of my colleagues at Carnegie Mellon studied Tandem Corporation, which has sites all over the world, feel more connected to the organization if they have this kind of electronic access. Another effect that you often hear people say is true, and the data primarily suggest is not, is that electronic communication cheapens interaction among people. By and large, what happens in organizations that use electronic communication is that it augments face-to-face communication. It adds to it. It doesn't replace it. And so people talk about electronic mail replacing face-to-face interaction. But by and large, what the data suggests is that instead of that, more people talk to more other people. Now, of course, that produces a problem, which some of you are familiar with, which is that also takes more time. And so we have this problem with folks who come in the morning and they spend an hour and a half doing their email before they get to do anything else. Of course, that's assuming that doing your email isn't doing something. But doing your email might, in fact, be doing some of the most important connecting work that you do with other people in the organization. There's some very interesting work. Oh, if you're interested in this sort of stuff, there's a book by Sarah Kiesler called The Culture of the Internet. That has some very good work in it about these kinds of changes that I'm talking about. The other person to look at, and this is with regard to the self, is Sherry Turkle, who's out of MIT. Sarah Kiesler is at Carnegie Mellon. Sherry Turkle has done a lot of work on how people have thought about who they are and what they do when they've had access to electronic media. I mean, one of the one of the characteristics about electronic media is that you're not limited by your physical abilities, and you're not limited by time. And so you can talk to people in Australia, and they don't know that you're a dog, as the old cartoon goes. They don't know that you're handicapped. They don't know that you're white or black. And in fact, many women use electronic login names that don't show their gender. So they don't use Susie. They use Anderson 2 or something, which doesn't give away their gender. And so they don't know even what gender you are as people interact with you. It's not tied to your physical self so that you can play an older person or a younger person. And many people on the web chat rooms, etc., have been doing precisely that. They've been playing someone of another gender. They've been playing someone who has been raped when in fact they weren't. They have been playing doctors. There's all sorts of sort of gaming about who I am that happens on the internet. Now, it's really hard to pin down how much of that there is, because how are they likely to tell you? My guess is that it's fairly limited, but I simply don't know of any data on how extensive that kind of gaming with a self is. Sherry Turkle has got a wonderful book called Life on the Screen, in which she talks about some of this gaming of the self, and where people try on, some men, for instance, have tried on the identity of women and have gotten a real education as they talk to other people and see how they're treated very differently when they're Susie instead of Fred. Another thing that you get on the internet that impinges on who we think we are is we get access to different groups. We can check out the Ku Klux Klan and find out what they're like. Or we can check out Buddhists. And the nice thing about being able to check out these groups on the web is that you don't have to go to the Buddhist temple and have people looking at you saying, what are you doing here? On the web, you can go to the site and look at what's there, and you're not making any commitment at all. So, by and large, they don't know that you visited. Yes, I know there's tracking software, etc., but most folks don't look at that. And so it's easy to do this kind of playing with your self-definition of who you are. And Sherry Turkle's point is that the self, then, who we are on the internet, may become more pliable. We may be more willing to try on other identities. And we may be more likely simply to be influenced by a broader range of people on the internet. I want to give you an alternative story to that, just because we don't have a whole lot of data. And the right way to do this when you're thinking about, when you're running off one of these stories, is to say, well, let's see if we can run off the other story and see how reasonable that one is. Another story is that what you get on the internet is access to communities of interest. And so people who are interested in golf all talk to each other. And people who are interested in evangelical Christianity all talk to each other. And Lutherans, God forbid, talk to each other on the net. You can think of, this takes on a more sinister tone when you think of anti-government groups all talking to each other on the internet, or members of the Klan across the country all talking to each other on the internet. And so we have talked about the fact that you can, in addition to getting this cross-fertilization on the net, you can also get information ghettos. where all the information you get is filtered through this one worldview. And you have access to now many more people than you thought ever there were who believed this thing. And it can help actually to increase your belief that this thing is true, because now, gosh, there's a bunch of people who think this way, and they're all over the world. So that's some of the background. I want to talk now about ways that religions are currently using the internet. If you look around, there's a nice book. I can't remember that Zaleski is the fellow's name. It's the title of the book is The Soul of Cyberspace. And it's not good social science, but he's got some very interesting interviews with people. Buddhists, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, various flavors of Christians who have websites and are doing interesting things with the net. Most religious organizations use the web for outreach, that is, to get a message out to people who aren't part of their group. This is particularly true for groups that are more narrow in their construction, like Hasidic Jews, Mennonites. There are Mennonite sites on the net. There are Amish sites on the net, oddly enough. They're not run by any Amish people. But the Amish folks do help out and explain things. There are some websites that or internet sites that are used for internal communication. I think the website for the ELCA is like that. How many folks have looked at that? Has anybody looked at the ELCA website? They have information for people who are in the church. There's also some outreach information on there. You know, what are Lutherans like? What's going on? One interesting thing that I've noted is that there's not very much worship going on the internet. And I want to ask some questions about that among y'all and ask some questions to find out what y'all think about that. Some Zen Buddhists have had a blessing of cyberspace. They got on the net together from several sites and blessed it. A student of mine and I have thought about putting up a shrine on the net where you could light a candle, a virtual candle, and you could let it burn down, and that would be a sign of a prayer, sort of like we do here in the evenings. The question then would be, would that be a holy space? But what's going on by the fact that we see lots of outreach and we see internal communication, but we don't see much worship on the net? I want to suggest some things, but I also want to get y'all's feedback on. There is some interreligious dialogue. Most of it is informal. I don't know of any sites specifically that are set up to encourage interreligious dialogue. I think partly because people feel like interreligious dialogue is a little dangerous. And maybe it's nicer to do it face-to-face, where you see a real person and you can see them smile or not when you say something. There are sites that encourage personal spirituality. The Benedictine Monastery, St. John's up in Minnesota, has got a whole lot of information on its website about Lectio Divina, which is the practice of reading the scripture and meditating. So there are sites on the web that encourage personal spirituality, not meant to be done on the net, but to give you information and encouraging you to do it in your own life. Those are sort of the ways I have seen it. If you've seen other ways, I'd be interested to hear. some of the aspects, I think, of the religious self, us as religious people, and I use the word religion rather than Christian, because I also want to think about Jews and Hindus and Buddhists and some of the other major religions that have access to the internet. I think one of them that's very important to think about is the issue of community. We think of ourselves as worshipers in a community. And that community is mostly local. When I think of my community, I think of a few places. I think of Holden, and I think of Northfield, Minnesota. But I don't think really broadly until my preacher tells me I should. But by and large, when I first think about community, I think about the folks who are in my local church. Tradition, I think, is an important issue. Our response in tradition to new things has primarily been a sort of slow accommodation to them. The internet has the potential, at least, of changing this. There are new political issues come up, new problems arise. By and large, the church is relatively careful and slow in its adaptation to them. Sometimes it's painfully and horribly and tragically slow, and sometimes it's too fast for some people. You get the broad range of reaction. Ritual in religions, by and large, is embodied. It's physical. We talk about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Buddhists want in what they call Dharma combat between a teacher and a student to be there to see the physical reaction and the sweat or not of the student when the teacher asks a difficult question. If we think of this in terms of the internet, community on the internet is dispersed. There's a wide range of people who don't have to talk to you, but talk to you primarily because it's maybe an interesting group to be in. And how might religious community work on the internet? Or would it work? One of the real difficulties that some churches face, for instance, go to the Roman Catholic Church's, the Pope's website. One of the things that you won't find at the Pope's websites are links to anywhere else. All roads lead to Rome. But this is an issue of establishing authority, partly, and they don't want to suggest that there are other places that have authority in terms of the magisterium, the teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. But there it is. And so there's an issue of establishing and of discerning authority. Is this the real Holden website? I don't know. There are a lot of people who have websites that have Holden pictures on them. And there's also this issue of the fluidity of how people talk about things on the net. And so you might find traditions changing relatively quickly on the net that you wouldn't find in local congregations. We've talked about the issue of ritual and the fact that it's embodied. I want to end simply by suggesting that there are limitations to the internet. I'd like to ask if there are things about ritual, about your worship, that you wouldn't want to do electronically.
I think there's a dynamic that I feel. When I'm in a group.
Like this one.
That I'm on the net a lot. It's part of my job. that I certainly don't get any way on the net. And I think that when it comes to religion and the net, I think back to when TV first started carrying religious services.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this feeling that, oh, this will be the church of the future. And yet, of course, it isn't. And in fact, it was quite unsatisfactory from a spiritual standpoint, emotional standpoint, depending on how you want to look at it. Because I think there is a dynamic that we feel, because I'm sitting next to you, that I will not get from across the
country. No, it was useful for some isolated people who simply couldn't get to church.
That's different.
But by and large, there's something you get by being there that you wouldn't get by being...
I think that's part of the spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
There's some things that just don't communicate well over the electronic media. I find myself, I work in one of those offices that has a lot of little cubes with computers in them, and I will very often send email notes to the person who's just over the wall from me, and I ask myself, why do I do that? But I also will poke my head over the top, and maybe that's the problem, I can't see over the top really. But I will do that sometimes, and when I thought about why do I sometimes send a note and why do I sometimes use spoken language, it has to do with what I'm saying. And is it something that needs to be kind of thought through carefully, and it helps me in writing it down to think through what I'm saying, or is it something that's more amenable to more casual conversation? I suspect that spiritual issues and religious practice may not be very amenable to being written down carefully, and we want that. You know, it's just not a good medium for communicating what we're trying to communicate.
What's left out? Yeah.
I'm curious about your concept of worship at that point. You mentioned this one thing about the candles light.
Sure.
Portray your concept of worship a little bit more, which sort of tossed out. But.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. I'm a layperson. I haven't studied this word in about 15 minutes, so I'm ready to be taken apart.
It's just fun to hear.
Well, the one thing that we were thinking of is if this were a site that a variety of people used and you lit a candle on it and it burned down over a period of time, you might show up at the site and you'd see seven candles burning. And you would know that seven people had been there in the past 15 minutes or half an hour and had said a prayer. From somewhere. And you would light your own. It would give you some feeling of community. Now, I use this as a thought example to sort of get people to think about what worship might be on the net. You'd get some sense of community. You'd get a sense of God-directedness, because it's about prayer. Certainly somebody could fake it, of course, but it's not like we never fake it on Sunday, you know.
But there's that phrase, whenever two or more of you are gathered in his name.
Right.
Well, now, does that apply electronically to being gathered?
Right. Cool. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting in our current church, you mentioned, well, prayer is one aspect of worship, and the women have a prayer chain, typical, but now it's on the internet, or it's on email. And it's not so much a chain anymore, because one person sends out the information and everybody gets it.
And everybody prays.
And everybody prays at once. But it's just different. I guess it's as effective. And then I find myself printing it out because I need to refer to it. So I'm one of those who prints them out. But it's different.
It might look a little awkward kneeling in front of your computer while you're reading through your email.
Right.
Several people have referenced television. I get the contrast there, as I do here, between being passively involved or actively involved.
Mm-hmm.
Worship, to me, is an active involvement. If you're watching on television, it's a passive involvement. If you were to be virtual, that would be passive.
Right.
Not active.
Now, would you think that this candle lighting ceremony that I was just talking about is active involvement?
I guess in a people sense, I'm still seeing that as passive.
Okay.
Because those people can't translate themselves past the virtuality of that worship.
What about the prayer chain that's done electronically? I like that example.
Well,
is that active?
The end result is active. Okay. Prayer is taking place. But
And it does have a sense of community. You know other people are praying.
I would put out another example of that. There are daily offices that are out on the web. And so it would be a way then of facilitating people who enter into commitment to pray together, but they're not together. It would be like lay associates of religious orders, or Saints Martin and Teresa, or whatever else. And so I don't know if that qualifies as worship, or if we're differentiating worship from personal devotion.
Right. But the lectionary is like that. Our daily offices is, in a way, used like the prayer chain. It's the dispersing of information to people who then use it for a religious purpose.
I was just going to say an addendum to that. It's nice to have it printed out, or at least to have it in print, because like the game that you play where you telephone this one name, by the time on a prayer chain on the telephone the message gets to you and your 10 down the line, the name may not even be the same.
Right.
So here at least it's in print.
That's right. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think everyone would agree that things like the sacraments can never be worshipized. So there's...
Does everyone agree that things like the sacraments can never be virtualized? What about confession, if you're Catholic?
I was thinking of the three,
TV tries. There are those that, lay their hands on the TV screen. Mm-hmm. It's very fascinating. I follow some of them. They've actually tried to sacramentalize them, and I don't know what happens on the internet. I'm not... But the TV tries to do that.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. To those of us who are more related to it in an intimate way, it's absurd.
It feels very strange to talk about the real presence in the television tube.
Yeah, but when you visit people who honestly are putting their hands on the television screen,
right?
You then kind of change you don't change your own thoughts, but you go, whoops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the internet can facilitate individual worship, devotion. I would call that worship. And I think that can enhance what we bring to corporate worship. But it cannot, I would make an argument, be a substitute at all in any way for corporate worship. But it can even enhance, like you said, it can enhance individual relations and relationships. It can enhance religious or... relationships as well, mm-hmm. that we would bring to worship. And regarding confession, I'm a pastor and I work with young adults quite a bit. And I've had college students tell me things on the internet at 3 a.m. when they get home from being out with their friends, interactions, things they've done, things they said, that they would never tell me because the moment would have passed.
Mm-hmm.
But they can sit down, they can write an email, they can send it, I can read it. And the next time I see them, I have that information, and they've shared it with me, and it's built our relationship. So in a way, it's been a confession. And then later on, I can have a chance to bring that up with them or talk with them. I don't think it cannot substitute in confession hearing the words that you are forgiven. Or it can't in any way substitute what happens when we gather. Right, hearing it this way, or seeing it or feeling it in some way.
Yeah, the Catholic Church, by the way, does, as far as I know, does not do confession on the telephone. It must be in person.
Well,
why don't we do you?
Yeah, just the fact of people going to movies. If you go to a movie by yourself, where you go, the place is packed, and it'd be hard to get data on that. But if the movie's funny or if it's serious, probably be difficult to see the same. But it's just, to me, a real difference when there's people around you and the place kind of erupts over something and what happens, or a joke.
Oh, yeah.
If you're by yourself, you don't erupt with it.
Yeah, the presence of other people,
the electricity
changes inside. The way you react
yeah.
to the thing.
And the noise of that and anticipation, whatever.
Yeah.
And the same people going to a concert. People are willing to pay $40 to go to a concert
right.
when they could get a CD would sound right. better in their home. But they're willing to go spend money and sit by
for people. The presence. And the that, real presence of the yeah. Rolling Stones.
The internet will not be able to do that. And the glow of a flame of a candle on a screen cannot do what a candle in front of
what
you
a real candle does. Right.
And there's no way it can do that.
Right.
I think we do need to acknowledge, though, that our Lord comes to us in many mysterious ways. You're making the distinction in worship. There are lots of ways our Lord can come to mm-hmm. us, and He can come to us through technology in ways that may influence the way we worship when we are in a corporate body.
And that's why I wanted to start this conversation. For instance, Thich Nhat Hanh is a Vietnamese Buddhist. Some of you are familiar with his writings. A lot of them are over in the bookstore. And many Vietnamese Buddhists were put into jail in solitary confinement in Vietnam because of their actions. And they had to think about the role of the Buddhist community, because in Buddhist thought, sangha, the community, is very important. And Thich Nhat Hanh began to talk about a way that a monk in his cell alone with a few insects could create a kind of community. Because here were people who were constrained. They couldn't have access to the Buddhist community. And we might want to talk about ways that Christians who are in their cells, because they don't have access to the community, they've been constrained, can create a sense of community, get some of the effects of a community. And as soon as we begin to do that, then we begin to think about ways that that might be communicated. I do want to say one thing, and that is that to give us some language to talk about this. Primarily when we talk about the internet, we talk about information exchange, either in the form of pictures or sounds or text. And I think something more is going on in worship with the candle than information exchange, or in a service with people around you than mere information exchange. It's not just symbolic. It's not just the bread is not just symbolic of Christ, at least for those of us who aren't Baptists, which is what I was raised. There's something more there. It's not just a symbol. And what you get on the internet is information exchange. And if we want to talk about something that's missing, we may want to talk about what it is in our worship life, in our spiritual life, that isn't about information. What thing is there? For instance, you might be able to get some of the feel of a community because you see 8 other candles or 15 other candles there. If you know that people treat this site with some reverence and that the candles really mean that those people are praying for something. And what if you do begin to get an effect like that effect? I don't know that we want to call that illegitimate.
It's part of our worship, though, is the creation of sacred space, sacred objects, mm-hmm. sacred time,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard for me to conceive of making sacred. I guess, you know, in theory one could do that, but I'm troubled by information alone.
Mm-hmm.
Can't have a much easier time thinking of sacred, thinking of the candle flame in its physical manifestation
mm-hmm.
as a sacred thing.
Right. I agree. And in addition, we tend with computing to have used it to chop up our lives into bits. And I don't know how likely a virtual prayer site like this would be to to help, how well it would help people get into the frame of mind of setting off sacred time. You show up at the website, you click that, and you're out of there.
I'm going to press you. Are you there, or am I not hearing? What do you have from your database and everything, the limitations of virtuality? What are you saying on that? Last issue there.
We don't have a lot of information on it. There's not much research.
I wonder why it was up there and how you intended to.
And to me, this issue of religious action, whether it be personal spirituality or corporate worship or the sacraments, is a wonderful way to think, excuse me for being a social scientist, it's a wonderful way to think about the limitations of virtuality. Because we have this really deep feeling that something's not there that ought to be there. Now, there's also some interesting research that suggests that even in video conferencing, if you set the video screens up so that when I look into your eyes on the video screen, you're looking back into my eyes on your video screen. And people, they've done the technology to do that, so I don't have to look over here to talk to you. And so you get something like virtual eye contact that still doesn't have the same effect as real eye contact in interactions. You still, in the experiments that people have done, it still doesn't have the effect as having the person there. It has a slightly bigger effect than not having eye contact, but it doesn't get you all the way there. And of course, there are people who have innovation fetishes, if you'll forgive me, about virtual reality, who will say, but yeah, when we get body suits and all this sort of stuff, and you really are there and you feel their hand pressing back on your shoulder when they lay virtual hands on you, you'll feel their presence. And we'll see. But I think it's going to be an interesting, next couple of decades as the church figures out how to deal with this issue. I want to make a couple of suggestions to close about how religious institutions should think about using their technology now. The first thing I want to suggest is you should think carefully about why you're establishing a website or a mailing list or whatever. Yours is a great example of some folks who thought, here's a need, the technology fulfills it, we'll use it. I have seen other churches that have websites, and I'm not really sure why or who they're for. It's sort of like a billboard in nowhere, because it's not clear it's targeted to anybody, but they thought, we're cool, we're going to have a website. So I would urge you to think carefully about who the audience is for whatever website or technology you plan on setting up, and how it will help them to interact with your congregation or your institution. Another thing I would suggest that you match is that you match your use of the technology with your values. It's easy to set up a website based on technical values instead of to set up a website based on spiritual values, Christian values. Let me suggest those of you who are thinking about this kind of thing in your church to go to the website for the Benedictine Order. And I can find it for you if you're interested. And they have an area called the Scriptorum that talks about how to set up a website to provide access to the widest number of people. There are folks in some countries who save gasoline for a week in order to run the generator to get connected for 45 minutes. And if your website has a monster picture of your church on the first page, and no way to get past that without a mouse to click on a part of it, that's going to waste a lot of their time and resources. There are folks who are blind who are on the net. There are all sorts of issues of thinking about how the technology is going to get at the other end to other people and what effect it's going to have. So I'd encourage you to go to that site and to look at their musings on that. Thank you very much for your thoughts. If you have other thoughts, I'm leaving on Tuesday, so please get in touch with me before then. This is just great fun to think about. Thanks.